Good evening, everybody. How are we doing? Is this side of the room like radioactive or something? The food's on this side. That's smart. That's very smart. Well, it actually is radioactive, but no, that's all right. Well, welcome to our Skeptics Forum on a Monday evening. I love these Skeptics Forums. I love the ones on Sunday. How many people were here at the one yesterday? Very good. So we have a lot of new people. How many people have never been to one before? Love it. Excellent. This is sponsored by the Paradox Sunday School class, which is in this very room from 11:15 to 12:30 every Sunday here at Sierra Madre Congregational Church. And Dr. Hugh Ross teaches that class, and during his talks, he takes questions, so we sort of reverse it at the Skeptics Forums. We welcome you to ask the questions, and he talks about whatever you want to ask about. So that's what this is about tonight. Paradox is a very open class. We love to ask questions. We love to really question. So I hope you brought some good questions, some provocative questions. I want you to know that no questions are too simple or too easy or too hard, or especially no question is too controversial. So please don't be politically correct. Okay, if you have a good question and you've always wondered about it, please come up to that microphone back there. And that's where you go. See that mic back there? If you want to come up and ask a question, there's a few basic rules. Really, just one. You can ask as many questions as you want to ask, but if there's a line, please ask one question and go to the end of the line. Thank you. In the news this week, we heard about how many people saw the Stephen Hawking interview on Larry King. Stephen Hawking said, "There's no need for God in the creation of the universe." It's very interesting what he had to say. I thought Larry King could have asked him some real questions, but that's not what Larry King does, so he got away with it. But that's the kind of thing we talk about in this class, so I hope you brought some questions like that. You know, the existence of God is probably the most important question that we can ask. There's so many things that are dependent on it. If God exists, then it gives us, as human beings, an automatic purpose to what we're doing. If God does not exist, then we really are living a life that has no purpose outside of ourselves. Now, that's in and of itself not an evidence for God's existence. But if God does exist, it's a very good reason to believe in Him. So, again, this forum is not to hear Dr. Ross talk his normal lesson. This Skeptics Forum is for each one of you to ask your tough questions and go up to that mic. Now, if you're shy and you don't want to go to the mic, find me and write your question on a piece of paper or tell me what it is or somehow convey it to me, and I will be very happy to go to the mic and ask your question. Okay? Are there any questions about questions? Okay, our speaker tonight is Dr. Hugh Ross. Dr. Ross, as I said, teaches the Paradox Sunday School class, which is here every Sunday from 11:15 to 12:30 in this very room. He is also the president and founder of Reasons to Believe. And if you're interested in Reasons to Believe, their website is reasons.org. Dr. Ross has a Bachelor of Science in Physics from the University of British Columbia, PhD in Astronomy from the University of Toronto. He is an ordained minister, and he has written about 14 books at last count, many of which are on the book table over there. So feel free to go over there and take a look at what he's written. There are some other things that we recommend over there that make good reading, so please check that out. And unless anybody has any questions, I'm going to pray and we're going to introduce Dr. Ross. Lord God, we thank you, bless you for this time tonight. We thank you for all the people that are here. We ask that there's some good, provocative questions that turn people in your direction. And we thank you that you gave us a mind to be able to inquire, and that you don't just tell us things in a superficial way, that you make it so we really have to own things to be able to believe them. That's really a blessing. And we ask your blessing on this evening, tonight, all the people here, people that ask questions, on Dr. Ross, and on each one of us as we go our way this evening. In Jesus' name, amen. Please welcome Dr. Hugh Ross.
Well, and Ross said that, ask as controversial a question you want. You don't have to be politically correct. Yesterday when we held this, the first question asked was by a woman and wanted to know whether the prostate was a bad design or a good design. So, really, anything goes. So, but what's the answer? It's a good design. So the reason why atheists, in fact, it's a very popular argument for atheism, is to claim that the human body is filled with bad designs, and therefore it's got to be naturalistic evolution. It can't be the handiwork of God, because why would an all-powerful, all-loving God give us things that don't work right? And the complaint about the prostate is that it tends, as we men get older, to restrict the urinary flow. And so, why didn't God put it somewhere else, or why didn't he design it differently? Well, part of the function of the prostate is to restrict the urinary flow during sexual intercourse. I mean, you don't want urine flowing all over the place when you're doing that. So, and the other thing is the prostate fulfills a critical role in allowing men to sustain an erection. And if you put it somewhere else, it won't work. So, and also in terms of the fact that you really want the prostate relatively close to the penis and the testicles. You don't want it somewhere up on your shoulder. So there's a reason why it's located where it is. And part of the reason why we complain about the prostate is that we men are living a lot longer. So the fact that we live so long means that, all the organs in the human body decay with respect to time. And what they say to men is, if you live long enough, you will get prostate cancer. But the thing about prostate cancer is it typically is quite slow. And so men can live to be 100 to 110 with the prostate cancer, and the prostate functions just fine. Occasionally, it gets aggressive, and it's got to be surgically removed. And I'm actually in that category. I had mine removed a year ago because the cancer was aggressive. So then I got to appreciate the design of the prostate. So still trying to appreciate the design of the prostate. So. But that tells you that no question is too indelicate or controversial to ask. Anything goes in this skeptics forum. But since no one has come to the microphone yet, what I'm going to do is just share with you a very recent scientific discovery that pertains to faith science issues. And I've got a whole bunch of them here just from the past 2 weeks. In 2 weeks, there's been about 50 discoveries that pertain to the Christian faith in the scientific journals. So I'm just going to keep going through these until you get to that microphone. Now, typically, I only get halfway through one before one gets going. But the one I used yesterday, well, it looks like I won't even get to it. So, but if things lag, I'll talk to you about leaf litter. Anyway, go ahead.
Stephen Hawking is certainly out there trying to sell a book.
Yes. It's been number one from the very get-go.
Really?
Even out selling the fiction books, that's pretty hard to do. Well, I've read several excerpts from the book. I'm a cheapskate, so I bought the book from Amazon, but it hasn't yet arrived. But a friend of mine has read through the entire book and gave me a synopsis of it, which is good because I was wondering, he makes a statement that, you need God to get the math set up and the laws of physics, but once God sets up the math and the physics, he can take a 14-billion-year vacation. And so his belief is, if there is a God, he can't be personal. And he claims that physics by itself can explain where the universe comes from. And I was curious, I mean, what is he appealing to? Because I realized back in the 1980s, he wrote a paper with James Hartle, a physicist at UC Santa Barbara, where what they did is they did a thought experiment. And they said, you know, what if we have two time dimensions attached to the universe instead of one? They said, with two dimensions of time, we don't have to have a beginning for the universe. Therefore, what need for God to explain the existence of the universe? And he wrote about that in A Brief History of Time, saying we don't really need God to explain the universe. However, he did say in his A Brief History of Time, which is still outselling his new book, A Brief History of Time ranks by far as the best-selling science book of all time. But what he did concede in that book was that all the measurements in physics and astronomy tell us the universe is constrained to a single dimension of time. Moreover, it tells us that that dimension of time, the passage of time, cannot be stopped or reversed. And where it can't be stopped or reversed, and where it's just one dimension, you have to have a beginning for all the matter, energy, and space and time and universe. In fact, Hawking's famous, what really launched him to worldwide fame, was he and Roger Penrose published the first of the space-time theorems. And with those space-time, that's what he writes about in A Brief History of Time, those space-time theorems prove that if general relativity reliably describes the dynamics of the universe, there must be a beginning to space and time that coincides with the beginning of the universe. And that being the case, you really do need a causal agent beyond space and time to explain where the universe came from. That was back in 1970. Today we have far more powerful space-time theorems. Space-time theorems that don't depend on general relativity. The most powerful of the theorems states that if the universe expands on average throughout its history, there must be this ultimate beginning to space and time. And, you know, evidence is quite clear that the universe not only expands on average with respect to time, it has been continuously expanding since the beginning of time. And he did allude in one of his interviews to a statement by Alexander Vilenkin that nothing is unstable. And again, Vilenkin was just doing a thought experiment. You know, none of these speculations are based on evidence. They're just mathematical thought experiments. And he said, what if absolute nothingness was configured in such a way that it would spontaneously split into something and anti-something? And that would explain where our universe came from. And he uses the analogy of particles and antiparticles. Well, the analogy doesn't really fit, because you can take a proton and an antiproton, and if they get close together, they will annihilate one another and produce energy. But energy is not nothing. It's something. Well, what I now found out that he does in The Grand Design is that he is claiming that the universe in which we exist came about as a result of a quantum fluctuation, a quantum event. And the analogy they use is the fact that quantum space-time fluctuations in the space-time fabric of the universe, will produce virtual particles. But we call them virtual particles because the quantum mechanics tells us that the virtual particle you produce from the quantum space-time fluctuations must return to the quantum space-time foam before any human observer can detect the particle. However, there's lots of experiments in physics that tell us virtual particle production must take place. So we know it's happening. We know the quantum mechanics can do that. Well, what Hawking and his co-author are speculating is that a quantum fluctuation is responsible for bringing the universe into existence. But here's a fallacy in that line of argument. The one thing we know about all quantum events is the probability of the event occurring is proportional to the passage of time. The greater the amount of time you have, the higher the probability the quantum event will occur. Well, at the beginning of the universe, we have the beginning of time. which means you're trying to explain where the universe came from with a zero time interval. If the time interval is zero, the probability is zero. So the universe could not possibly come about as a result of any kind of quantum event, whether it's space, time, matter, energy, whatever. They're all ruled out because the laws of quantum mechanics are established such that if no time goes by, there's nothing that can happen at the quantum level. So all three speculations to avoid God are proven wrong by the physics. So it doesn't mean there won't be new speculations. But the bottom line, in fact, there's a journal of physics called Physics Letters B. Almost the entire journal is devoted to what-if speculations. You know, let's just dispense with reality, and let's just conceive of a universe like this. In fact, a lot of that is in the grand design. Let's conceive of the universe having five dimensions of space. I'm not talking little ones, five big dimensions of space. Well, we have no evidence those dimensions exist. But what they do is they say, if these five exist, then we can have these mathematical formulations of the universe that are radically different than the universe that we see. But we have zero evidence that those dimensions would apply. I won't say zero. The Bible actually speaks about other realms with different dimensions, the place where the angels dwell. And so from a biblical perspective, there is, actually is some support for what Hawking refers to as M-theory, different dimensional realms. But it's the intervention of God from beyond the dimensions. That's the thing that the Bible tells us about God, is he can create dimensions at will, he can remove them at will. In fact, the promise in the Bible is, once evil is conquered and removed by the Creator, then the universe and all of its space-time dimensions will cease to exist and will be replaced by a brand new realm with very different laws of physics and very different space-time dimensionality, which I think is going to be disappointing for Hawking, because he claims he's on a mission to discover the all-encompassing theory of physics that will give him the mind of God. Well, even if he were to achieve that, there are other dimensional realms that God has created. And the dimensional realm in which we live will one day be no more. But the irony is, Stephen Hawking's own space-time theorems prove that no human being can ever learn the totality of all the physics of the universe. It will always be limited, which is good news for us astronomers, because it means we'll never be unemployed. There will always be more things to learn about the universe. Well, unemployed for the right reasons. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, my question is really asking you to comment on global warming. So I know that there are people who think it's a conspiracy. It sure looks like, from the TV shows that we see, that, you know, there's a lot of evidence that shows we're in a period of global warming, and some of this devastation is very sad to see. You know, and recently I watched a TV show about an island, I guess, off the coast of Indonesia or somewhere in
off of India, right?
That the land is disappearing quickly from this island, and the people are having to retreat, but they're not being welcomed. In any case, but we also know there are ice ages, because we really, and historically, were recently in an ice age as recently as, what, 14,000 years ago?
15,000 years ago.
So my question is of you, and if you could comment, what are we likely to see in this warming period? What more things might we expect to see over our lifetimes? And when can we expect to enter a period of, you know, chillier weather?
Okay. Well, chillier weather will come if you wait long enough. There's only so long you can put off the next ice age. And as we look at the past 10 million years of Earth's history, we see that it's been on a 100,000-year cycle. And a 100,000-year cycle is driven predominantly by the variation in the eccentricity or ellipticity of the Earth's orbit. No orbit of any body is perfectly circular. The Earth's orbit is close to circular. But, for example, we are closer to the sun in the wintertime than we are the summertime, for those of us who live in the northern hemisphere, which actually is a good thing because it ameliorates our weather, And I would argue it's not an accident that 80% of the landmass is above the equator, because given the present state of the Earth's orbit, that's where you're going to have the most evenness of the climates from summer to winter. And notice, if you look at the continent, look at a globe, there is very little land area below 30 degrees south latitude. And that's where the difference in the sun's distance would have the greatest impact, roughly between 30 degrees latitude and 90 degrees latitude. But if you discount Antarctica, you got a tiny sliver of South America, and you've got a little bit of New Zealand, and that's it, in terms of parts of the world that could be negatively impacted by the fact that in the southern hemisphere, you're closer to the sun in the summer than you are in the winter. However, that ellipticity changes with a 100,000-year cycle. And what that does is it gives the Earth a 90,000-year-long ice age with a 10,000-year interglacial. And we can see this through the ice cores in Greenland and Antarctica, and also in the cores off the shelves of New Zealand, that trace for the past 4 million years has been this regular 100,000-year cycle. So in that context, we're 5,000 years overdue for the next ice age. We should already be into the next ice age, but we're not. And the credit for keeping us away from the next ice age is predominantly the domestication of cows that occurred about 10,000 years ago. And one thing scientists have learned about global warming, it's not the burning of fossil fuels that's the biggest contributor to the human factor in the global warming. The biggest factor of all are the gases emitted by cows. The second biggest factor are all the forests we've cut down to make pasture land for the cows. Number three are the fossil fuel gases, or the gases we emit from burning fossil fuels. But the cows is what has held off the next ice age. Now, what a number of scientists are pointing out is that the combination of cows, the pasture land, and see, the pasture land's increasing. Because of the human population today, the demand for cows has gone way up. And what we're seeing is meat consumption is increasing, especially in the undeveloped world. The Chinese and the Indians are eating beef almost to the same extent that we're eating. Well, not the Indians, but the Chinese, beef to the extent that we are. And so the beef industry has just skyrocketed in the last 100 years. And then, of course, we have the burning of fossil fuels. And so the analysis from the scientific community is we're doing a whole lot more than we need to do to stave off the next ice age. And consequently, as you point out, the Maldives off of India are predicted to disappear. I mean, that's a nation. An entire nation will disappear from the face of the earth because of rising sea levels. And probably the strongest evidence that lay people can appreciate for global warming is that the Northwest Passage is now open. It's been closed for thousands of years. But now you can send freighters across the Canadian archipelago, ice-free. And that's not been possible until the last 10 years. Arctic ice cap is now only half of what it was 200 years ago. So clearly things are happening. Now the big debate is how much of this warming is natural and how much of it is the result of human activity. That debate is still raging. And because climate models are difficult to construct, the scientific community's consensus is the human factor is not trivial. Whether it's the majority or not, we don't know, but it's certainly at least a very large fraction. What I mean by that is a quarter or a third or more of the effect. Now, as you're probably aware, there are a number of politicians and scientists who are advocating that we take drastic action to deal with this global warming. One got the Nobel Prize, who said what we need to do is eliminate the factories, eliminate the cars and trucks, and that will help us relieve the planet of global warming. kind of reminds me of what we tried to do in this nation back in the 1930s, outlaw the drinking of alcohol. Well, it's hard to enforce a law that nobody wants to obey. And telling people they can't drive. Can you imagine telling your teenage boys that they can't drive a car? How are you going to be able to enforce that? Or if we shut down all of our factories here in the United States, what's going to happen? Those factories will move to nations that aren't worried about global warming. So it's going to be very difficult to enforce. Moreover, we argue at Reasons to Believe it's completely unnecessary. That if you look particularly at the book of Job, it tells us that God in advance designed the earth, the universe for that matter, and all life on planet earth, so when we human beings are faced with a crisis in managing the planet for the benefit of all life, that's the command God gave to Adam and Eve. He says you're in charge of the planet, you're to manage it for the benefit of all life. And what you see in the book of Job is you've got three chapters that tell us how to manage the planet for the benefit of all life. All you got in Genesis is a one-sentence command. But in Job, you've got three chapters that actually explain how to do it. And that makes sense because there's very good evidence that the content of Job predates that of Genesis by at least 400 years, if not 600 or 700 years. And so there's no need for Moses to give the details. The people already had that. But the thing you see in the book of Job is that God has designed the earth and its life. So we're faced with a crisis in managing the planet for the benefit of all life. In advance, he's already provided a solution that is simultaneously optimally economic and optimally ethical. You will not have to sacrifice ethics to boost the economy. Neither will you have to sacrifice ethics, sacrifice the economy to do the ethical thing. So that's my big critique about Al Gore. He's asking us to make draconian economic sacrifices to do the right thing, when in fact God has provided us with solutions where we can do the right thing and make a lot of money at the same time, and also increase the health of the human population and increase the benefit to all life here on planet Earth. And if you're curious, read Job 38 and 39. It lays out exactly the things we need to do to deal with human global warming. And here's the tip. What you'll see, especially in Job 38 and 37, is that God blessed the earth with optimal precipitation, optimal snowfall, optimal ice formation, optimal rainfall, optimal dew and fog, and that what we humans need to do is make sure we don't disturb it. But we have disturbed it big time, really big time. For example, the Sahara Desert is 10 times the size it was in the days of Julius Caesar. And we can take steps to bring the Sahara Desert back to its original size. And it can be done fairly quickly. But we have to stop the abusive practices that produced the Sahara Desert in the first place. And here's China with this huge burgeoning population, but because of abuse, the Gobi Desert is 3 times bigger than it was 2,000 years ago. Now, taking steps to shrink those two deserts down would be huge. It would provide a food supply for the people living in that area, because in the days of the Romans, it was what's now the Sahara Desert that fed all of Europe. It was the breadbasket for the Roman Empire. Today, it feeds nobody. So it would provide a food supply. At the same time, the vegetation that you would have there would soak up lots of greenhouse gases. And I just wrote an article for our Today's New Reason to Believe feature on our website about whales and how the reduction in the whale population over the last 200 years has been responsible for adding 2.2 million metric tons of carbon to the atmosphere, which traps huge amounts of heat. And so if we were simply to bring the whale populations back to where they were 200 years ago, that would be a whole lot of carbon pulled out of the atmosphere. At the same time, it would generate a huge food supply for all the life in the land. Because what they discovered is whales fertilize the oceans. And you take the whales away, the fertilizer is gone, which catastrophically drops the population of phytoplankton, And when you drop the population of phytoplankton, all life in the ocean suffers, and it also causes all the fishery industries to suffer. So everybody wins if we bring the whales back to the populations that they were 200 years ago. And the remarkable thing is, we thought there was a dozen whale species that were doomed to extinction. All dozen are starting to recover. But we could recover them at a much faster rate if we were to take action. So, and we could have a whaling industry again. So everybody wins. Read the book of Job. God has always given us these optimal solutions. Yeah.
Evolutionary scientists look at the fossil record and see a long line of species with a lot of what they call transitional species between the larger ones. And if you're an evolutionist, you look at that and you say, you know, that makes perfect sense. Of course, these species become the next one after it. But when you read the Bible, it says that each one was made after its own kind. How do you reconcile what we see in the fossil record with what the Bible says about each creature being made after its own kind?
Well, this is timely because our staff biochemists, Fuzz Rana and myself, are going to be spending most of tomorrow dialoguing with some leaders in the theistic evolutionary camp. And that's their primary argument. They said, you know, it can't be God because you look at the fossil record, you see things starting over and over again. And if you're going to give God the credit, then that really looks like God doesn't know what he's doing, or he's creating by trial and error, or he's a bumbling creator. So the question is, how do you explain from a biblical perspective all these interruptions that we see in the fossil record? And, you know, Charles Darwin thought the fossil record was a continuum. We now know that's not true. What you see is life existing on the face of the earth with immeasurable change, and then it gets wiped out to a large degree, anywhere from 20% to 95% by some terrestrial or extraterrestrial disaster. But after the recovery from that disaster, you see a mass speciation event. Where life proliferates in very different forms right after the mass extinction event. But once it's put in place, it again exists for tens of millions of years with no measurable change, then it gets wiped out, and you get that repeating over and over again. And we can see it's been repeating at a rate of about once every 20 to 50 million years throughout the last 800 million years. So how do you explain that from a biblical perspective? Well, it's important to integrate the 66 books of the Bible in order to discover what the Bible is really saying about these complex issues. Likewise, it's crucial in science that we integrate across the scientific disciplines if you want to really understand what's happening here. And the problem is you have evolutionary biologists who are looking at this issue of the fossil record strictly from a biological perspective, and failing to take into account what's happening at the area of physics and astronomy. And so we think it's going to be an interesting discussion tomorrow, because what I'm going to be talking about is, well, you evolutionary biologists presume that God has given us a solar system and an Earth that remains constant for 4 billion years. Astronomers know that's certainly not true. The sun today is 15% brighter than it was when God created the first life 3.8 billion years ago. And it's easy to understand why. The sun is a gigantic hydrogen bomb. It's continuously fusing hydrogen into helium. But when it fuses hydrogen to helium, it makes the core of the sun denser. And the denser the core, the hotter it burns. So as the sun gets progressively older and older, it becomes brighter and brighter with respect to time. Now, life can only tolerate about a 2% change in the solar luminosity. And if you want life to be optimally abundant and diverse on the Earth, it can only tolerate about a 0.5% change. And so what's crucial for the Creator is as the sun gets brighter and brighter, He must step in and remove life from the planet and replace it with new life that can compensate perfectly for the changing luminosity of the sun. It's life that's responsible for regulating the atmosphere of the Earth such that as the sun gets brighter and brighter, the life on planet Earth works to remove greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. And actually it was the other way around when the Earth was really young. Because when the Earth was young, the sun was actually getting dimmer instead of brighter. Because when the sun was young, it was losing mass. And the luminosity or brightness of a star goes up with a fourth power of its mass. And so at that juncture in the history of life on planet Earth, God was removing life from the planet, replacing with new life that would add greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. But about 3 to 3.5 billion years ago, he reversed it, where he's creating life at intermittent points that would take more and more greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. Now, there's an implication in all that. The implication is we human beings are at the end of the line, because this intervention by the Creator to keep replacing the life with life that is more efficient in removing greenhouse gases from the atmosphere has a limit. If you remove too many greenhouse gases from the atmosphere, photosynthesis will cease. The green plants that God talks about in Genesis 1, they take carbon dioxide and water from the atmosphere and then through photosynthesis convert that into sugars, starches, and fats. But as the sun gets brighter and brighter, there will come a time when you have to pull so much carbon dioxide and water in the atmosphere, those are both greenhouse gases, that photosynthesis will cease. You say, when's that going to happen? Well, it will happen for all life in less than 30 million years. But advanced life will be the first life forms impacted by this. So that would mean that we human beings are history 5 million years from now at best. But actually, if you read some of the articles we publish at Reasons to Believe, we think the end of humanity is going to be coming in thousands of years, not millions of years. There's other factors at work. But that's what we do notice, is that 3.8 billion years of life history, and then at the very end, God makes human beings. Why did he put us at the end? Because that way we have the benefit of 3.8 billion years worth of biodeposits that we can exploit to launch and sustain civilization. We are the beneficiaries of 3.8 billion years of previous life. For example, without 3 billion years of bacterial activity, we would not have metals that we can mine to launch metallurgy. The human species would have never developed technology without mineable metals, and wouldn't have that if it wasn't for 3 billion years worth of sulfate-reducing bacteria. So when you celebrate Thanksgiving, you might say a little prayer and thank God for the blessing of all those sulfate-reducing bacteria. Go ahead.
My question is a little bit about what you were just talking about. In terms of advanced life, some people say we have the tipping point now. In terms of advanced life being able to be on Earth, could you comment on that?
Well, we are past the tipping point, as I've already mentioned, because the sun's getting brighter. There's a limit to how long we can be here. But there are other factors that would come into play much more quickly than that. For example, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, they're worried about the next big meteor that crashes into the Earth. And literally, it's just a matter of time before we get hit by something really nasty. And that's going to happen in less than 30 million years. So that would be bad news. But we have argued at Reasons to Believe that, well, let me give you another one that's really firm. One of the things we notice about the sun, it's 4.5 billion years old, and it has enough nuclear fuel to burn for 9 billion years. But one of the things we observe about all stars, they have their maximum stability when they're exactly middle age. It's a lot like human beings. Humans are unstable when they're young. They're unstable when they're old. They're maximally stable when they're middle age. Stars behave the same way. They're very unstable when they're young and very unstable when they're old. But the thing we've noticed by looking at neutrinos coming out of the sun is evidently the sun entered an exceptionally stable luminosity phase 50,000 years ago. And we also know that that can only last for another 50,000 years. So, and when we go out of that stability zone, then we're going to have a whole lot more than these climatic cycles to worry about. Things will get much more dramatic. That's been the blessing of the past, 15,000 years, is we've had the optimal climatic conditions throughout that period of time. But that's unusual. There's only been one cycle of the ice ages that have given us that kind of stability, and it won't happen again. So 50,000 years from now, we're not going to have that exceptional solar luminosity stability. But there are two other factors I think are going to hit us much more rapidly. And you can blame them on our wealth and our technology. Statistics show that the wealthier human beings become, the fewer children they have. Because what happens with wealth is you tend to urbanize. And when you urbanize, then it's no longer an economic advantage to have 8 kids. You got to send them all to Harvard and, the tuition these days. They all want cars and they don't leave home till they're 30 years of age. So, that highly motivates people not to have a whole lot of children. The other thing is technology. With technology, you have to really prepare a lot more for your career. 200 years ago, a young man was ready to support a family when he was 17 or 18. That's no longer the case. You've got to get a master's degree, and you've got to get all this training. What I'm seeing with my sons is it's not enough to get degrees. You also have to have internships. And nobody pays you to do an internship. That's all thanks to mom and dad that they take care of that. And what that does is basically delays the time by which you can get married and have children. For example, I didn't get my PhD till I was 27. I didn't get out of my postdoctoral experience until I was 30. So that was really the first time in my life that I could even financially conceive of the idea of getting married, let alone having children. But what's happening is more and more of the world's population is in that spot of being forced to delay marriage and forced to delay having children. Now, not a problem for the women, but it's a big problem for the men. And notice that men tend to marry later than women. The older a man is, the more deleterious mutations he passes on to his children. Now, there's only one nation in the world where we've made measurements of the deleterious mutation rate, the United States. And it was done about 10 years ago. It's obviously much higher now. But 10 years ago, it was 3 deleterious mutations per person per generation. Now, genetically, the species is guaranteed to go extinct if the mutation rate is 1 deleterious mutation per person per generation. We're already 3 times higher than that. What does that mean? That probably means that if we maintain our wealth and our technology, then we will disappear from the face of the earth in about 1 or 2,000 years. So that's the thing that's the most immediate in the future that we have to worry about. And now there is a solution. The solution is to drop our population and return to the Stone Age. That way we can last for, say, another few tens of thousands of years. But I think it would be rather difficult to convince our children or our grandchildren to abandon wealth and technology. Go ahead.
I've noticed over the past 5-6 years or so that summer, normally, the heat of the summer will end about September. But I've noticed over the past 5-6 years or so that the heat has gone on until the holidays. My question is that a contributing factor to global warming? And also, there has not been much rain either. So, is that my question? Is that a contributing factor to global warming? If not, then what is it? And if it is there a way for the Earth to redeem itself to get back to the normal weather pattern than what it was before?
What's the message you see in the Book of Job? Is that in terms of managing the climate of the Earth, pay attention to the precipitation. That's a much more reliable indicator of what's going wrong than the temperature changes. So let's focus on, and so you're right. We need to look at where rainfall patterns have dropped and where they've increased. And those of us who live here in California have noticed that the rainfall is not as great as it used to be. You know, last year we had an El Nino, but it was puny compared to El Ninos we had in the past. So we are definitely getting less rain. But also global warming will cause parts of our planet to be wetter. For example, the eastern seaboard is getting more rain than they normally get. And so, but according to the book of Job, let's look at the places where we've disturbed the rainfall patterns and bring them back to where they were. And in the process, that will help us deal with global warming simply as a byproduct.
What chapter of Job?
Job 37 and 38 are the two chapters that focus on precipitation. But they describe six different kinds of precipitation. So it's not just enough to look at the raindrops. For example, here in California, far more important than how much rain we get is how much snow we get. Because we tend to get a rainfall in a very short period of time, but the benefit of snow is it takes time to melt. So it gives you a continuous supply of water that you would not get from rain. That's one of the biggest concerns. If we warm the planet too much, then California won't get any snow at all, and then we'll really be in trouble.
We have a question from the audience, Hugh.
Okay.
What happens to the millions of people who were born and died before Jesus' birth, who never knew anything about him and his salvation?
Okay, good question. Often stated as, what about those who've never heard? Well, we've been talking about the book of Job, and Job makes the point that everybody's heard. One of the clearest presentations of the gospel message, the plan of salvation, you'll find coming out of the words of Job. And he wasn't the only one. Elihu backed him up. Now, the three friends, the three comforters, got it really messed up. But Job was able to appeal to his three friends, and what he did is that he would look at aspects that you could see in the record of nature and use that as evidence for the different points of the plan of salvation. What's remarkable to me reading what Job says is that it's just like reading the Roman road in the Apostle Paul in the book of Romans. It's that clear. Now, Elihu is not quite as elegant and doesn't quite get it as crisply clear as Job does. But there's good evidence that Job was put together before the Hebrew language took written form, probably predated the advent of Hebrew as a written language by at least 400 years. But it was set up as poetry for good reason. It was set up to be easily memorized. And so people had that record. Now, the one thing we need to say as a proviso is that the remarkable thing about Job and to a lesser degree Elihu is they were blessed with great humility. And it takes humility to see the clear presentation of the gospel message in the record of nature. I would also argue it takes some measure of humility to see it in the Old Testament and the New Testament. But yes, people say, what about the Old Testament era? One of the clearest presentations of the message of salvation through the Messiah is in the book of Deuteronomy. And that's been around for, you know, 3,500 years. And so the Jews had it right there in the message. In fact, what you notice in the book of Deuteronomy, Moses keeps exhorting his Jewish compatriots. You think the law will save you. It will not. What will save you is the one that will come after me. And what he says, you must listen to and obey everything. And God will provide. They said it's a future provision. Just like the new creation is a future provision for us today. And that's something you see throughout all 66 books of the Bible. It keeps exhorting you to look ahead to what God will do in the future. And so that's the thing that Moses stressed in his last sermon to the Jews before he died, is don't depend on the law, depend on what will save you from the consequences of the law, and that will be the prophet that comes after me. So, but also he made it very clear, and you see it in the book of Ezekiel, which says, you know, if you will trust in God's provision, you will be saved, but if you trust in your own good works, you will not. And then basically explain how God will judge us. We will get weighed in the balance, that depending on what we do with God's offer to help us with the struggles of life, God will either remove all the bad that we've done. I mean, it's still a weighing out in the balance. But what Ezekiel points out in the 18th chapter is depending how you respond to God's offer, one scale will be empty and the other will be filled. And you get to choose what scale will be empty. And so for the believer, there is no accounting for the evil that has been done in that person's life. You will only be judged on that which you've done to glorify your Creator. But for the one who's rejected God's offer help with the problem of sin and evil, he says it's the reverse. I'll remove all the good and judge you based on that which has been displeasing for me. And as you read Ezekiel 18, the Jews did not like that. And God says, well, remember what Isaiah said, all your righteous deeds are as filthy rags in my nostrils, because they were done to elevate man, not to elevate me. And says, I'll do you a favor, I won't count those good deeds against you. It's the motive that counts, not the deed. Okay.
What happens after your physical body dies? What happens to your spirit, to your soul?
Good question.
I got a few more after this.
Okay, that's fine. As long as there's no line behind you, you get to do that. You'll find in both the Old and the New Testament the claim that every human being knows that life will continue after death. And that explains why we respond to death differently than the animals. Everybody knows that judgment's coming. Now, this is what really causes the human to fear death for those who don't have that relationship with their Creator. They realize when they die, it's not all over. There will be a judgment. And so when you look at an animal that dies, it's a very different kind of response than when a human being dies. As to what exactly happens, I was just talking about Ezekiel 18. Ezekiel 18 says when you finish this life on earth, you will be weighed in the balance. And it'll be your good deeds versus your not so good deeds, your evil deeds. But, as Job points out, none of us can lead a righteous life by our own effort. The only way we're going to make it is if we receive help from the Creator and have Him step in and take our place. You know, Job speaks about the Redeemer, the Advocate, the one who will take care of all the offenses that he has committed against his fellow man and against God. And he says, I know that my Redeemer lives. I will see Him on the last day. In my flesh I will see Him, even though my skin has decayed away. And so that was Job's confidence, that because he was putting his faith in what God would do to take care of all of his evil deeds, that he indeed would be with God in the new creation. And so you have a choice. As it says in the book of John in the New Testament, if you will receive the truth that God gives you and respond to his call to salvation, you will proceed to salvation. But if you reject that truth, you'll proceed to condemnation. And that's kind of what Ezekiel says. You have a choice. You can let God save you, or you can try to save yourself. If you try to save yourself, then all that stuff that's on the good side gets erased. And you'll be judged for what's left over. Now, what's clear is that the lake of fire, hell, Gehenna, is a place where people get different levels of torment. Not everybody gets tormented at the same. As it says at the very last book of the Bible, for those who've done much evil, there will be greater torment. So there's every benefit for the one who has rejected God's offer to still lead as good a life as possible. You get a better place in the lake of fire. You get to live in the penthouse rather than the basement. But that's also true of the righteous. It says, for those who have received God's offer of salvation, that there will be different rewards. You don't all get the same reward. You'll be rewarded dependent on the degree that you have used your life to bring blessing to others and to God Himself. So there's different levels of reward in the new creation. Yeah, got a follow-up.
All right, so I'm Alan. So when I die, will I know I'm Alan? And my spirit is still, I mean, will I remember this life? Will you meet your loved ones? Will you I mean, my mother's gone. Would I be able to well, assuming that we're both believers, or would we see each other?
Well, you'll not only see each other, they'll be there to greet you as the Messiah takes you across the threshold. That's what it says in Psalm 23. King David says that when I die, God himself will come and escort him across the threshold of death. So you get a personal escort. And if you look in the New Testament, Stephen, when he was being stoned to death by the Jewish unbelievers, as he was dying, he said, I see heaven open, I see Jesus there, he's calling me to come. And so Jesus came down and personally escorted him. And I've had the opportunity to watch some people die. A pastor in this church has seen hundreds of people at the threshold of death. And my own father went through this experience where he said, son, tell me, what's it like to die? And I said, well, probably a few days before you're about to die, you'll start feeling really confused. That's where all your organs are starting to shut down. And that's kind of gives you a clue that you've got 2 weeks maximum left, maybe just days. But then about 2 days before you die, you'll feel a real sense of comfort. Suddenly all the discomfort and confusion will disappear. That's your signal that you're probably within 24 to 36 hours or less of being taken across a threshold. But at the very moment, you will hear your name. Jesus will call you by name and take you by the hand and take you across that threshold. As you get across the threshold, there will be a crowd waiting to greet you and congratulate you. So the dead in Christ that knew you when you're alive will be the first ones there to greet you.
I would desperately want to see my mother.
Sure.
It's very close to her. But what if she doesn't want to see me?
Well, if she's in the good place, she's definitely going to want to see you.
Yeah, but you don't know what I was like when I was...
Well, the good news there is that, you know, as we cross that threshold, as it says in 1 Corinthians 3, we go through refining fire. And it's talking about the righteous. And basically what's happening there is all the nasty, objectional, obnoxious stuff within us gets consumed away.
Can it consume me now and just get rid of it?
No. I mean, well, you're supposed to work to remove the obnoxious stuff now, of course.
That's too hard.
Well, that's why God still has you here, is to take care of all that. But he says whatever's left over, he will remove. Okay, he will remove that. And so the wonderful thing about life in heaven in the new creation is that everybody you meet is going to be like the most fascinating person you've ever been with. All the obnoxious stuff is gone. There will be no bores in the kingdom of heaven. So it's going to be a wonderful experience. And of course, that's going to be true of us. All the stuff that makes people despise me will be gone.
But if heaven is all beautiful and everything, I mean, I still can't grasp this. Isn't beauty because there's ugliness? I mean, somebody can be beautiful. If everybody's beautiful, there's no beauty. You know what I mean? It's all the same. So if heaven is all this paradise and beauty, how could it be like that when it's always like that? You know, you have to have...
Well, have no fear. There will be different levels of beauty, and there will be different levels of reward, but there won't be any ugliness. All that will be gone. And none of us will be ugly. You know, those of us who have the opportunity to go to the new creation, everything ugly about us, everything obnoxious about us, will be removed for all eternity.
My good looks, I mean,
you'll have your good looks, but your obnoxious behavior will be completely gone. So, and that'll be true of all of us, right? Which means we're going to be excited to spend time with one another in new creation. I don't know what it's like. Sometimes you walk into a room and there's people there you know, and you say, I want to stay as far away from that person as possible. That will never happen in the new creation. Okay, go ahead.
Back to the global warming thing. I've read different things about sunspots and their influence on global warming. Is it a theory?
No, it's more than a theory.
And second of all, wasn't there a Middle Age warming?
Mm-hmm.
So what was that caused by? Or do we know?
Well, we don't know exactly, but you are right that the number of sunspots on the sun does affect the luminosity of the sun.
I'm hearing right now that we're, I guess since 98, the temperatures have been kind of stable and that we don't have a lot of sunspots.
We're not seeing a lot of sunspots. I mean, we're solar maximum is due at 2012. And, you know, by now we should start seeing lots of sunspots, and we're not. So that's telling us this is probably going to be a rather tepid solar maximum. And that usually means higher global temperatures.
Oh, higher?
Yeah. Well, because the more sunspots you have, basically sunspots are caused by magnetism. And so instead of heat coming out of the sun, you get magnetic energy coming out. And so there's a slight drop in the solar luminosity. Now, it's really tiny, but, you know, it can make a difference here on planet Earth.
But back to the Middle Age warming, do we have any idea what caused that? Because, I mean, wasn't it quite a bit warmer?
It was quite a bit warmer. I mean, there was a really cold period during the Middle Ages, and there was also a very warm period, warm enough where they were growing grapes in England.
In Greenland, they were the Vikings, I think, were farmers at the time.
Right. Had to take off. That's exactly right. The current theory or hypothesis is being tossed around to explain both of those episodes is a change in the Gulf Stream. Because what we see in the ice cores in Antarctica is that the mean temperature of the planet didn't change much. But evidently there was a dramatic change going on in Western Europe. And changes in the Gulf Stream could explain that. So, in fact, there's some analysis where they say if the Gulf Stream shuts down, that initiates an ice age. So, and typically it takes warming to shut down the Gulf Stream. That's the enigma. If we get a lot of warming, it could bring about the ice age.
There was a mini ice age in the 1700s or 1600s?
A mini ice age. Okay, he had a warm episode that lasted a couple hundred years, followed by a cold episode that was shorter in duration. So that's what makes climatology so difficult. I mean, trying to figure out what's man's fault and what's the fault of natural cycles is not easy. And also we're discovering that, you know, the whales play a factor in determining what kind of stuff happens in the ocean. So it's not, you got to integrate again. Yeah, go ahead.
I told her to go, but she said I should go before us. I'm trying to, I guess I'm asking these childlike questions because my brain can't somehow comprehend some of these more scientific global warming and all this. But, you know, if you take, say, person A, who's a very righteous man who tries to do good things and praises God and prays to God and says, I'm doing this on behalf of you because you created me. I suppose that's the right thing to do. But what if you take somebody, I'm thinking of my uncle. I mean, he was an Orthodox Jew. He was a very good man. I don't think he would ever even mention the word Jesus. He believed in God, but he never mentioned the word Jesus. I'm trying to figure this out. It almost seems like he's playing a game. Like it's, I sometimes think of the Santa Claus song. You better watch out. You better not pout. Santa Claus is coming. You know, you better be good. I'm not trying to belittle it. I'm just trying to figure this out and grasp it. I mean, some people say they're filled with the Holy Spirit, and that's a sign. So I prayed that if Jesus if he was really resurrected, show yourself. I mean, I'm willing to believe, but just show me something. But what I can't figure out is if you believe, yes, I believe that Jesus died for our sins. So you commit a sin and you say, gee, I'm sorry, I apologize, I repent, but you do it again, let's say, or you don't do it again, whatever. It just seems so weird that you're going to spend eternity in heaven because you believe that Jesus died for your sins, and if you do good things but you don't believe it, see what I'm saying? It just doesn't make sense. And the fact that he was crucified is an excruciating thing. That's how they came up with the word excruciating, crucifix.
Right.
And he spent, I don't know if he spent 2 days in hell during those 2 days. And again, I don't mean to diminish this. I'm just saying there was the sacrifice. But now, he ends up with his father, with God in paradise for eternity. So where is the sacrifice other than the 2 days that, you know what I'm saying?
Sure. Well, this is something you see addressed in detail in both the Old and New Testament. Job said it first, that, who else has tried to live a more righteous life than Job? And yet Job in his righteousness recognized, I'm a total failure in satisfying God's standards of righteousness. No human being can meet God's standards. And that's not difficult to discern. You know, God has given us a conscience. He's written his law in the heart of every human being. And every time you violate that law, if you're paying attention to it, you feel the pang of guilt and conviction. And what you notice is on the slightest infraction, the conscience reacts. And what that tells us is God does not grade on a curve. He's demanding perfect moral performance. And none of us can attain that. But what Job reasoned by looking at the record of nature is when you look at nature, God is clearly extremely powerful, all-powerful. He's also all-loving, and he's also all-knowing. He's got to be extremely wise. And he says, given that we human beings are in a hopeless dilemma to save ourselves, in his great power, he must have provided a means by which we can receive that salvation. He's loving enough to want to do it, and he's smart enough to figure it out. And Job discerned that it couldn't be anything other than God himself, because only God is perfectly moral. So he says, I'm going to put my faith and trust in the advocate, the redeemer, the one that will take my place and pay the penalty I can't pay. And he says, because I'm doing that, I know with complete assurity that I will be with my Creator on the last day. I'll see him in my flesh, even though my skin is decaying away, because I'm putting my confidence in the only thing that can deliver me. Now, my point there is, he didn't know the name of the Messiah. He didn't know it was Jesus of Nazareth. He lived before the Messiah. But he knew there was a Redeemer. He knew the Redeemer had to be God himself. He knew the Redeemer had to pay the price for his personal offenses. So that's what the death of Jesus of Nazareth on the cross is all about. He takes our place and pays the penalty we can't pay. So it's kind of like my son getting a traffic ticket. He got one a couple of weeks ago. His bank account was completely empty. So I stepped in and paid his traffic ticket for him. I didn't have to do that, but I decided to do that. He will pay for it later. So, but that's kind of like it is with God, is that we all have a traffic fine that's, $10 quadrillion, way beyond what we can possibly take care of. But in his great mercy and in his great wealth and love, he decides to take our place and pay the price for our redemption. And so that's the message of the Old Testament. It's the message of the New Testament. And the promise that you see in the book of John is that God has sent his truth to all human beings. We've all gotten revelation through nature, through the Bible, through the people that God sends to us. And the promise is, if you'll receive that truth and own it, he'll give you more. But if you reject that truth, you'll get even less. And so I never worry about someone that I see on the pathway of receiving truth. I know that God is going to keep his promise and give more truth to that person until they come to faith in Jesus Christ. But I worry about those that are in the practice of rejecting and refusing the kind offer that the Creator made. Because what you also see in the scriptures is that that person will lose even what they already have. Because what's happening is they're becoming more and more resolute in their pride and saying, I don't want God doing it for me. I want to be God or be like God and do it myself. And that's the person who has diminishing opportunities to receive. But as long as you're continuing to grasp that truth, receive it, understand it, own it, the promise is you'll get more. That's true for the believer too. I mean, when you give your life to the control of Jesus Christ and ask him to pay the penalty in your behalf, the promise still holds. As you continue to study and learn from God and receive the truth that He gives you and respond appropriately to it, He'll give you more. Which is why He keeps all of us alive, right? Because we're still in that pathway of learning more and more and getting rid of all that obnoxious stuff in our life. And, you know, that's the wonder of visiting people who are decrepit and aged in the hospital or rest home who've been following Jesus Christ for 50 years. I remember seeing my wife's grandmother in her last days. You walked into the room and she just, there was a glow about her. He just wanted to be around her. She was just incredibly attractive, even though she was just days away from death, because she had had that practice of receiving that truth on a daily basis. Or as the Apostle Paul puts it, every one of us who's alive right now are in a state of decay. Your bodies are rotting right before your very eyes. But it's a slow process of rotting. It takes years or decades to really notice a significant difference. But he says, you know, the wonderful thing about being a believer is that if you're following Christ, you can be visibly transformed on a daily basis. So it might take years to notice the physical decay, but it only takes 24 hours to notice the transformation in the spirit of the person. And that's what's so thrilling about being a follower of Jesus Christ and getting old, is that, you know, we don't worry about age because it gets better and better on a daily basis. So we can rejoice in the rotten decay of our physical bodies. Something else you can think about at Thanksgiving, right? Okay, go ahead.
This is a much different subject. Apophis. Again, as an asteroid which is due to pass by Earth and not hit 2027, but potentially can after that. Could you discuss that? And if it were to hit, what would happen to my
Earth? Okay, what would happen if we get clobbered by one of the asteroids that JPL is very carefully following in our behalf? It depends how big it is, and it depends what angle it hits the Earth at and what it is made of. About 25% of the asteroids are solid stainless steel. So when they hit, they cause a lot of damage, as opposed to the ones that are kind of rocky. And some of them, like the comets, for example, are like 85% frozen water. And so as they go through the atmosphere, a lot of that water melts. So yeah, we're much better off being hit by a comet than by one of those stainless steel asteroids. And if it's a head-on collision like that, it's going to do a lot more damage than if it collides like this. So all that makes a big difference. And then the size of it makes a big difference. And it does more damage than you might think. I don't know how many of you have been to the Meteor Crater site in Winslow, Arizona. It's worth visiting if you've not been there. It's almost a mile in diameter and 350 feet deep. The asteroid that caused that crater was only 100 feet across. So it was a relatively small rock that blew out that hole. The energy release is calculated to be about 50% greater than the Hiroshima atomic bomb. So that's 100 feet. Now, if you're talking 1 kilometer, that will not wipe out all of humanity, but it would be devastating to an entire continent. So if you get hit by something that big, yeah, it's going to cause lots of damage. If it's 10 miles in diameter, it'll wipe out all life that's bigger than 1 centimeter across. So it'll even take care of the ants and termites. So.
Would it change the course?
Not much. So, I mean, there's a big stir about that huge earthquake off of New Zealand that actually slowed down the rotation rate of the Earth. And so people were saying what a huge disaster that was, but actually it was microseconds. So it was a very tiny change. So yeah, when an asteroid hits, it will have an impact, but it's going to be very difficult to measure, unless it's really big. You have to reset the atomic clock. And that's something that physicists do every New Year's Day, is they reset their clocks, but not by much. I mean, for example, just the gravitational pull of the moon is enough to slow down the rotation rate of the Earth. When God created life for the first time on Earth 3.8 billion years ago, the rotation rate of our planet was 3 or 4 hours a day. It's now 24 hours a day. About 250 million years ago, it was 23 hours a day. And so if you wait long, it'll be 25 hours a day. You will have more time in your day. But the ideal day for human civilization is 24 hours. That's another reason why God made us at this point in cosmic history, because 24 hours is the best for us. And in the future, it's going to be a longer day. And that would make for bigger temperature differences between day and night. So in order to keep our air conditioning bills under control, it's only 24 hours. Go ahead.
Question, obviously, is talking about world population. You were talking, obviously, about how the birth rate in developing countries are going down. I've also read articles, obviously, how China realizes that their one-child policy is kind of led them to future doom because they can have one child have been aborting females, so their male population is much higher than their female population. And, of course, they're not replacing themselves. And I guess the countryside now, they're allowing, you know, two or three children because they realize that. Little publicized India, obviously, is because of a developing nation because, again, they don't regard women as humans, that they've been using technology to abort their females also. The AIDS Africa, AIDS in Asia, it seems like the world population is on a great decline. I read one article that said that they predict in about 50 years, the world population will continue to grow in 50 years. It will take a sharp nosedive at that time period.
Right.
Have you read anything, obviously, that has any projections beyond that 50 years? I haven't seen anything about that. I mean, obviously, people are predicting, you know, civil unrest is you have all these young males that can't find females, and of course the elderly population without people to collect their trash or cook their food or whatever. They're predicting, obviously, you know, a lot of problems in that regard. Have you seen any detailed projections on world population or problems that will cause?
Well, a member of our paradoxes class, Mike Phillips, has been involved in a research study on that very thing, and that unless something happens to bring down the trend towards increasing wealth and technology, his research shows that by the year 2100, the human population will be down to 1 billion. So that's a factor six less than what it is right now. And yeah, that's what the projections show. The population will continue to increase to about 2050, then there's a catastrophic drop thereafter. But there's a lot of assumptions built into that study. Number one is that things remain politically stable, and that wealth continues to increase at the present rate, and technology continues, and that wealth and technology spread to the developing world, not just to the world that's already developed. So any change in those assumptions could cause a different scenario. The problem of the India and China favoring men as opposed to females could cause much greater problems. And then with China, you got the other fact that a lot of people have been raised with no brothers and sisters. And one of the things about being an only child is you get used to the attention of both parents. And so often people who have no brothers and sisters expect a lot more from society than those who have had to share. And then the problem is, as they become adults, they have the potential of being really disappointed by the lack of progress in their own lives or their nation, and they begin to become a problem. They begin to become very demanding in an unrealistic way. And that's just something that's been observed by single or by only children, that children have no brothers and sisters, is that they tend to be more selfish and more demanding. Oh, yeah. Right. Right. Well, I mean, it's the older people that begin to complain about it. So, but probably far more problematic is the problem of having too many men. What we've seen, because there's been times in history where populations have gotten rid of their females. Sparta was a good example of that. And without exception in history, when a nation begins to have a huge excess of men, they go to war. They want wives. So, you know, one of the things that concerns me about China is they've been exporting all their female babies to the United States. Could there come a time in the future where they say, we want our females back? And would we be willing to give them back? So that could cause some unfortunate political tensions.